Hey there, I'm Sandy Scarlatta, and welcome to the Happiness Solve podcast. Twice a week, we explore the journey to finding true happiness by sharing inspiring stories, practical tips, and insightful conversations with some of today's leading experts. But we don't just scratch the surface. We dive deep into the real grit of what it takes to live a genuinely happy life. Whether you're looking to improve your well-being, enhance your relationships, or simply add more joy to your life, you're in the right place. So grab your favorite beverage, get comfortable, and let's dive into today's episode. Because happiness is a choice, and the choice is yours. Ellen, such a pleasure to have you on today. Thank you so much for being here. We had a little therapy session, you know, off the books before we started. Thank you for that. I needed that this morning.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for having me, Sandy.
So, for the audience, Ellen Schuette, right?
Yep, Schuette, like okay. Parachute. Yep,
like parachute. Ellen Schuette. Yeah. Ellen is the president of Empowerment Partners of Bingen Farms, Michigan, and she's a clinical social worker who provides psychotherapy to individuals, couples, and families, as well as consultation in the workplace. You've done a lot of great things. You work with a lot of different people. You've been featured in numerous print and broadcast media outlets. Your book, What Drives You, is available on Amazon or through local bookstores. And you have a podcast, too. And is it called What Drives You?
Yes, it is.
Love it.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's dive in. So for first of all, before we get started, because you just shared with me your age and I can't believe it. And thank you, because I, as I was just saying, I turned 60 this year. And, you know, like 5+ years ago, I was like, you know, I'm going to be 60. You know, I'm just going to retire. And now I'm like, heck no, I'm not retiring anytime soon. So thank you, because I have to be honest with you. When I first got back into this space after taking a hiatus and going into corporate for 10 years, I really thought that I was too old.
Yes.
Because I've been a certified life coach since 2004. I've been speaking around the DC metro area since the late 90s. And it was before the online space. So you met people in person. Everything was in person.
Yes.
That's how I love meeting people in person. And the online space is so different. And so when I got back online and I'm like, oh, you know, I got to start promoting myself. And you start comparing yourself to all of these young, beautiful women who are doing the exact same thing. And by the way, they're 20 years younger. And in my mind, that's what people want. And it took me a few years, literally it took a few years to really break through that limiting belief. I'm like, wait, you know, I have 59 years of wisdom under my belt that nobody else has, right?
That's exactly right.
It is mine. And I own it. And by the way, I look and feel better than I ever have in my entire life. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm in my second marriage. And when I met my husband, I was 25 pounds heavier. And then I lost weight. But then, you know, it's been like the, you know, roller coaster ride. But I've actually lost a little bit more weight just because I made some very good lifestyle changes. And he's like, I can't believe, look at how good you look. I'm like, yeah, this is the body that I had when I was 34 years old and got pregnant with my son. And my body it's taken me since 34 to get back to that figure.
Wow. Wow. Good for you.
That's amazing. I'm like, all right, let's do this, right?
Yes, right. For sure.
All right. So enough about me. So Ellen, tell us your backstory and how you got into this work. I mean, obviously social work is an area that you're called to. Because it's not for the faint of heart. It's not an easy job. So thank you for what you're doing, because we need people like you out there. So how did you get to this place where you are today?
How I got to this place is that I grew up in a family, and my book uses a car as a metaphor for a family. So I'm going to be speaking in terms of the car. Even if you grow up in a family that doesn't actually own a real car, my car is a metaphor, and you can imagine your own car when you were growing up and how it impacted you. And so my car growing up was a car where my father sat in the driver's seat and my mother sat in the passenger seat, and I was an
only child. Without seatbelts.
Yes, without seatbelts. And I will also say that my father was in the driver's seat, but everything he did was something she told him to do. So it was really sort of her in the driver's seat. But whatever that was, I sat in the back seat by myself. This was a second marriage for my mother. My birth father and her divorced when I was an infant, 18 months old. And I didn't really have much contact with him after. And this is a man who was in my life from the time I was little. And they finally got married when I was 7.
Oh, wow.
But if you think of that in terms of a car, when I was born, I was the child in the back seat. And there was a father in the driver's seat and a mother in the passenger seat. Right. And then when I'm 18 months old, all of a sudden, this driver of the car is gone. And in those days, they didn't talk about it. And most people don't talk about it to an 18-month-old baby. But at that point, my mother had to move into the driver's seat. And as her only child, or as a child of hers who was now divorced, I moved up into the front seat next to her, metaphorically. Right. And she and I were a pair, as happens very often with single moms, that a child or all the children become their passengers in the front seat, their partners in some way. And then after, 6 years of that, then she moved back to the passenger seat. My new father came and was the driver, and I was again in the back. And I spent my life in the back seat of that car by myself. They did try to have more children, but were not successful. And every car has its rules. And the primary rule in our car, sometimes rules are spoken, like we don't do that. Sometimes rules are covert and they're not spoken, but everybody just intuits them. But in my car, the primary rule was spoken, and that was that little girls are to be seen and not heard. So people my age, I think many little girls who sat in the back seats of their cars felt that way. And it was a rule for girls, which is really interesting because that rule did not exist for boys back then, but we didn't have any boys. But my job in the car, everybody has their role to play in the car. And my job as the only child was to be the good and perfect child. And I wanted to be the good and perfect child because I had already been through a series of cars and I wanted this one just to stay how it was. And so what happened for me was that I grew up feeling like I didn't have a voice. Like they weren't really interested in what I had to say. They were much more interested in their conversation between themselves. I wasn't allowed to have feelings. I wasn't allowed to have needs. I just needed to look pretty and sit in the back seat. And in my family growing up, looking pretty was very, very, very much about your weight. And my weight was never where my parents wanted it to be and only got worse as I grew up because looking back, I think I was protesting. And because of this, I grew up in this car where I learned a lot of things. We all learn so much in our cars. And some of them are good and some of them have served me well and some of them have not served me well. So I always felt that I wasn't good enough. I wasn't pretty enough. I wasn't thin enough. I made noise when I wasn't supposed to. And this not enough, I believe that most people have some not enough, but
for sure.
But that really hung over my head. I felt like I was a disappointment. My parents wanted me to be this just tiny little thin girl, and I disappointed them in that way. And those things were really, really hard for me, and I have suffered from those things in my adult life. The things that were good were that I learned to be very independent. I learned that if I needed something, I was going to get it for myself. Mm-hmm. I learned not to rely on people. That can be a good thing and a bad thing. But my point is that the learning that happened in that car stays with us. And in that car, we develop beliefs about ourselves, belief about others. My beliefs were that everybody was going to think I wasn't enough, which didn't turn out to be true. That didn't matter. But that was the belief that I developed in the car. While I was growing up, I had many friends, always had many friends, was very connected outside of my family. I had no extended family either. So it isn't like I had an aunt's house that I would go to. But I was close with my friends, and I would ride with them, go places with them in their family cars. I would be with them a lot. Mm-hmm. And their cars were so much different than mine. They were noisy, and people were crying and screaming and interacting. And my car was just this perfectly, like a photograph, you know, of right. a family, not real. Yeah. And I always was jealous of them that had siblings and had all this activity. And when they went to school, their sister or their brother was two grades behind. I didn't have any of that. It was just me on my own. And I didn't like it. And I have come to realize and understand, I did come to realize and understand after a lot of work, that these beliefs that I left my car with about me were not true. They right. just were not true.
You are taking that on.
Completely taking it on. And most right. kids do take it yep. on in the car. Right. So I grew up, I got married, I had three kids, and we created our own car. And in this car, my husband at the time, my kid's father, was in the driver's seat. I was in the passenger seat. And I envision it as like a minivan. And my seat was like turned around facing the back in our car because I was very, very involved with the kids. So I have two daughters and a son. My oldest daughter was in the seat behind her father, and she was the good and perfect one. She was the high achieving, all A's type person. My second daughter was also very, very smart. But what happens in cars is that two people can't take the same role. And we intuitively find another thing to be in order to get our parents' attention. So my good, smart, wonderful daughter, who was in second place, was the type of child who, she was born 5 days apart from a little boy who lived next door. Our families were best friends. So she basically had a twin that she grew up with, they were always together. And she was the kind of kid that just kind of took care of herself. She always did well. She didn't need any rules or boundaries or anything. She was just a really good child. And then I had a son, and his seat in the car was in the way back. And his role in the car was to be annoying. That was his role in our family. He was going to start stuff up. He was never bad. He was just annoying. And my seat was turned around because he either instigated stuff with his older sisters, or they instigated stuff with him to get him in trouble. Okay?
So, typical boy, right?
Typical boy, yes. And I am very lucky. My three children are all married, and I have seven grandchildren, and they all happen to live near me. And
that's wonderful.
I live in the greater Detroit area in Michigan. And so once a week, we all have dinner together, the 15 of us.
Oh my gosh, and that's awesome.
It is.
So you were able to create what you didn't have growing up, and you were able to do that as an adult. That's really amazing.
Well, whole adulthood has been about not being my childhood.
Right. Yes. Well, I think most of us try to do that, and we may not be consciously aware of it.
Right.
You're sitting there telling the story, Ellen, and I'm going, wow, my biological father died when I was 18 months old.
Oh my gosh.
And the difference is that my mom was 26 and became a widow at 26 with four children.
Oh my goodness.
And I was the youngest at 18 months old, and she'd never worked a day in her life. She was married at 16, had three kids by the time she was 20. And then she married my father, my stepfather, when I was three. So we've got very similar,
But for me,
it wasn't the me being alone. I had the older siblings, and then they did have a younger child, so I was one of five. But I have an only child. I have an only child, a son, and I had five pregnancies and one child.
Yes, right.
And when he was probably 6 years old, he came home and begged me. He's like, "Mom, please, I don't want any siblings."
He's like,
"I don't want any siblings," because he would go over to his friends, and all of his friends had two siblings. It was usually a family of three.
Yes.
Seems to be a common number. Family.
Yes,
like, I was really happy with two, but people have, they have, I have so many girlfriends that have that third one, and they're like, "I love that third one, but
oh yeah, put me
over
so
much
the
harder."
Yes. Right. I totally get it.
So yeah. So he was like, "Mom, like, I don't want any." And I said, "Well, good thing for you, because it's not happening." And I ended up getting my tubes tied because I was in my early 40s at that point. He was a miracle baby. I was told I would never have children. And,
oh, wow.
And, you know, so I'm grateful for him. But, you know, I'm now hoping that he has the multiple children, and then I can have just a couple
That's
of grandkids.
Right. You can have dinner for the whole family. It's the greatest, absolutely the greatest thing in my life. And I'm now with a second husband. So,
same.
Because, yes. So this is all not with their biological father, who is very much in our lives. We all live in the same community, but So when you talk about like beliefs and how they hold us back, and it wasn't until I was with this second husband that I really believed that I could do stuff, that I was capable, and that people would want me. And it wasn't until then that I went back to school to get my master's in social work so that I could go to work. I had been a stay-at-home mom all that time. It was in that master's program that I actually met my future husband. We weren't married for 6 years after that, but that it was life-changing for me. And what I learned in that master's program really set the tone for the rest of my life. I became a therapist. I worked at a large community organization as a therapist, and became actually the head of the counseling department there. And I'm in private practice now. But after I did that, 5 years after graduate school, I started teaching at University of Michigan in the School of Social Work. And it was in that School of Social Work that I developed this concept of the car, which I used to teach my students about understanding families better.
Yeah. And hence what drives you. I love that.
Exactly. Yes.
Well, you know, I do a lot of work with my clients as well, even though I'm a peak performance expert and I work with athletes and entrepreneurs, we all have family stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's literally, for me, it's just about recognizing when you're triggered. And let me just say, if this is, you know, how you view it, you're triggered and you just have to figure out, okay, where's that coming from? And you just have to keep, allow yourself that quiet time so that you can figure out, where's that coming from?
Right.
And then you recognize, oh, that's my father's. That was my father projecting his own insecurities onto me. And I took that on, and it's not mine. That's his shit. Take it back.
Yes. 100%.
My
book is about. Yeah. I have another sentence that I add there, which is about learning to have compassion for the person who's still saying those things.
Right.
I was taught it. Of course I'm going to say it. I have to unlearn that and give myself permission to learn something different now at this point in my life. So that the highlight of my book, I believe, the real reason I wrote it, was to develop self-awareness. Wow, look at me. There I am doing that thing.
Right.
And understanding, I do a lot of work with people understanding how they learned it. And so that they can eventually get to the place of saying, well, of course I do that. I was trained to do that. I was marinated in that.
Right.
But I don't have to do it now. Now I have choice. So
yeah,
the book is about self-compassion. I think that if you're part of a SIB ship and you understand who sat where in your car and why they did and what their roles were, it's about compassion for them. Ultimately, I had great compassion for my parents because this was just all they knew. And they only wanted the best for me. They weren't trying to be mean.
Right.
And they didn't understand that someone didn't have to look exactly that way and could still be important and valuable and that people would want to hear them. They just didn't get it.
Well, Ellen, my gosh. I mean, we're just now in 2025,
right,
recognizing people for their worth, no matter their size.
Exactly, right.
And it's always been like that. But you know what? Here's the thing. I was having a conversation this morning with my husband. We were talking about my weight, and I mentioned that earlier.
Yes.
It's very hard for me because I was a competitive figure skater growing up. And because I had such a large family, you know, being a competitive athlete growing up and, you know, back then, I mean, this was in the 70s, nobody really paid attention to our diets and whatnot. My mom thought that there was something wrong with me. I was teased to the point where as an adult, I didn't want anybody paying attention to me because I had so many mean girls calling me anorexic.
Yes.
And boys making fun of me because I was so skinny. They, you know, made fun of my legs, just the whole thing. And so now it took me years to kind of be okay with that. But and now I totally forgot where I was going with this. Sorry, folks. We know
it's
I'm
okay.
A squirrel sometimes. But the thing is like it goes both ways. Right?
It
goes both ways,
yes.
Whether you're too skinny or, right? Because I know there's times when you see a thin woman and you immediately say, oh, she's anorexic. Well, that's not fair to do. It's not fair for anybody
100%.
To make those judgments.
Because
we don't know, maybe she's sick with cancer or something, right? We don't know.
Of course, we don't know.
But I
will tell you, I've worked with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of women and never, ever, ever worked with one that thought her body was right and good.
And we're not born that way, folks. We are not born that way. That's external things projecting onto us. And what I was trying to get at too is that not only, and I love the having the compassion for the other people because that's so, so critical, but for me, it's been all about because I had so much trauma growing up. And we all do. And we all still, you know, we're still having trauma. I had an incident last night, which I don't need to go into,
yes.
But I was traumatized last night with me and my dog. Anyway. The thing is that it's getting to the point where we're able to look back at it with neutrality.
Yes, I agree.
It happened. I don't need to place emotion on this because it just happened. It is what it is. I'm going to not look in the rearview mirror, right? I'm going to look through the windshield in front of me and drive the car forward because I use that analogy a lot too, instead of looking in the rearview mirror because we can't drive your car looking in the rearview mirror. However, we live our life looking in the rearview mirror and focusing and putting so much emphasis and power into what happened to us in the past.
I completely agree.
You got to take that power back, right?
You do. I'm a big sports fan and I'm a big University of Michigan fan. And last year they won the national championship.
Woo-hoo.
And they would talk to these players about how do you do it? And what they said over and over again was, I just keep my head where my feet are.
On the ground.
Which is not about what happened before.
Yeah.
It's about where my feet are right now. I just stay where my feet are. I bring myself out of those negative thoughts about what just happened and what I did wrong and what I should have done better just to right now, right here. And that's the work that we can do in the present moment. That's what, when we're in the present moment, we don't have to be driven by what we learned. We can be driven by what we're currently thinking and what we imagine would be best for us, rather than the learning that may exist in our bodies, because it's in everybody's bodies. That's where children's learning goes, is into their bodies. Right, exactly.
The body keeps the score.
It sure does.
I have not read that book, but I know exactly what the book is saying. And, you know, we hold trauma in our bodies. And it's it's sometimes it's we have to release that angst in our body before it can be cleared up in our mind.
Oh, for sure. And that takes self-compassion, self-soothing, mindfulness, all those things. Right.
Right.
However you do that. So I've also used this metaphor in the workplace, especially with teams, because it's just
amazing. Talk a little bit more about that.
Yes, it's just amazing how teams are like a car.
Right.
There's a driver, there's a passenger, there's somebody in the way back trying not to get noticed. There's all of these players, and many people just assume their old role in a car when they get into a team. I know I did that at my work.
Interesting.
Oh, yes. So I wasn't going to go to work and think I had something to say. I was never taught that I had something to say. It took me a long time to develop that voice and to think I had something to say. And it's interesting that the two types of work that I have done, whether it be therapy or speaking, a lot of public speaking or teaching, are all things where people want me to use my voice. Now, remember, I was a little girl that I didn't have a voice. I didn't even know what to say. And so the way that my adult life has been framed, and this is just completely unconscious, is to put me in places where I would have to have a voice, not where I would have to worry about volunteering up my voice.
Right.
I've gotten much better at that too. But the roles that people play in their teams really can affect productivity. They can affect team efficiency. They can, most of all, affect the mood of a team and how well people work together and how well they're able to access their best stuff.
Yeah.
Because if the driver of the team is a controlling kind of person,
you're not going to get your voice heard.
You're not going to get other people's best stuff.
No.
If you're going to control it, you're missing out on all of the rest of it. But this always happens, almost always happens unconsciously. They're just used to stepping up and being a leader, and they don't know how to let anybody else have the floor. You know what I mean? Right.
Oh, yeah. I do know what you mean.
I'm sure you do.
Because for me, as the one of five, and I was the fourth.
Yes.
I can take charge of any situation, but if somebody else wants to take charge, I sit in the back seat. I'm like, go ahead.
Of course.
You got this. I just like, go for it.
Right.
You have the floor. Please take it
over.
That's
right. That's right. Yeah. I'd like to know about the oldest in your family.
Oh, she's, my sister.
Is she a take charge kind of person?
Not at all. No.
Okay.
No, my sister was... She's 7 years older than me, so she was 7, 8. So she was nine, almost nine, when my father died. So she immediately had to take on the role of caregiving.
Oh, yes.
She was the one who watched everybody. She had to take care of me. Hmm. She had to take, because my mom had to get a job.
Right.
So I would go to preschool or daycare. It was really daycare, preschool, whatever. And then, but then she would be watching everybody before my mom got home. And, you know, so anyway, but she's... You know, she was a nurse. She was a career nurse. She retired, and
look at that. She went from a step in mom to be a nurse.
Oh, and she always wanted to be a nurse, like from a very, very young age. Like she was one of the candy stripers at 13, 14. Ended up, you know, having her master's, had a full career in nursing for 40 some years. You know, so it was interesting.
Look at that.
Yeah, the family dynamics. Well, we could talk about this all day, Ellen. Is there anything else that you want to share with the audience before we finish up?
I really just want to share that my book, which is, it's a small 84-page little workbook, is just chock full of questions and things that you can ask yourself to really understand your family and your role in the family.
Nice.
And, what that, what you left that car with.
Right.
And what you still hold on to today. And the process also of how to change some of that that you left your car with. Yes.
Love it. And where can they find that?
The easiest way is on Amazon, but you can order it through any bookseller. Yes.
Okay, perfect.
It's called What Drives You.
What Drives You.
Yes.
And your website is ellenychute.com. That will also be in the show notes. So please look up
and
Ellen.
This is the book. Yes.
Oh, there we go. What Drives You? Oh my gosh, I love the cover.
Thank you.
I love
you see
it.
That car?
Oh, I love it.
Yes.
I love it. How our family dynamics shape, hold on, let me read that again.
Yes.
How our family dynamics shape the people we become.
Become.
Love it.
Yes.
Become.
Thank you.
Beautiful.
Thank you so much.
All right, Ellen, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
And folks, thank you for joining us. And I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you do, like it and share it with your friends and family. And I hope you and your family are happy and healthy and that your lives are filled with peace, joy, and lots of love. Take care, everyone.